This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
How long did it take to make this?
I think that is, they can finish one day. Wow. Because of, according to design, some design are difficult.
I had a look at Fashion Valley. I think it's still open on my tab. I'm like, this one. It's really nice. I mean, and the colors, like, do you guys choose the designs and the colors yourself?
Yes.
It's cool.
We don't have separate designer.
So you're the in-house designers.
See, let me see.
Okay, sure. All the women are designers.
All the women are designers.
I think this one is making by my husband.
Really?
That's joking.
Yeah, my mom's husband also. Okay.
Some of the ladies you just heard are refugees who are part of Mangta, a community of refugee women from Myanmar who are helping other women to develop skills to empower them with income, confidence and self-worth in the midst of the kind of tragedy and danger that most of us have never known. This is Raise Your Game. I'm Tasha Fusil, and today we celebrate World Refugee Day by speaking to Yanti Ismail from UNHCR and these two strong and courageous women from the Mangta community.
My name is Sarah. I come from Myanmar, so I already stay in Malaysia, going to 7 years. So I'm working now Mangta. Before part-time, I involved 2 years. Then after that, now I'm working in full-time coordinator in Mangta. So thank you.
Okay, and how about you?
Yes, I am Hannah. I come from Myanmar. Arrived in this Malaysia since 2008, and I'm working in Mangta since 2010 in part times. In that times, I'm working position is assistant coordinator, but now treasurer.
Okay, you're the treasurer of the of the group. Okay, cool. And how about you, Yanti? You work closely with refugee communities within Malaysia. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do?
Sure. Thanks so much, Tasha, for having us on the show. With UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, we work really closely with groups like this. Hannah and Sarah represent a group that's community-based, meaning it's set up by the refugees themselves, and it's a refugee women's empowerment program called Mangta, and that was what they were explaining. Both of them have jobs within that particular group, and it's a group that's been around for a while, to at least 10 years that I've known of them, and it's an amazing project which the women will tell you more about, to really look at supporting refugee women who have unique vulnerabilities as refugees and empowering them so that they are able to better take care of themselves and their families.
Just to get a sense of the scale, how many women make up the population of refugees in Malaysia?
Well, right now, there's about 151,000 refugees overall registered with UNHCR in Malaysia. Women are actually about 30% of that. So it's not the hugest population, but it's a critical population. It's a population that needs support because of their unique vulnerabilities. 93% of refugees in Malaysia are from Myanmar. And that's why groups like Mangta is important, to support such a large number of refugees. But we do also have refugees from other countries, like Sri Lanka, Somalia, Pakistan, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and they make up that 151,000, all of whom are in Malaysia and considered as undocumented migrants because they don't have a legal status in the country. Refugee status is not recognized here. And so these people exist in what we call the grey sides, the grey parts of Malaysian society. Projects like Mangta and many, many other projects set up by the refugee communities is probably the best way, the most practical way for refugees to find an approach to support themselves while they're here in Malaysia, helping themselves find solutions to their own problems.
So this is all done, you know, within the purview of the government?
Well, let me just explain a little bit about the context of Malaysia and why it becomes a little bit complicated when people are coming together to work to provide support and protection for refugees. Malaysia is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention, but on top of that, it also does not have any frameworks in place to manage the refugee issue, no legal frameworks in place, meaning there are no refugee laws. UNHCR is here in Malaysia the way we are in many countries when a government is unable or unwilling to take on that responsibility. responsibility of protecting refugees, and UNHCR comes in and we provide that protection work on behalf of the government. So here in the country, we work very closely with the Malaysian government and with many, many civil society partners in Malaysia. But the core protection work is still done by UNHCR in, you know, meeting refugees for the first time when they're seeking asylum. They're coming to us and asking to be registered, to be acknowledged as a refugee and not as an undocumented migrant. We're doing that kind of work. We're working with NGOs so that they come together and support refugee groups. We also work with the government. So we're advocating with the government for better protection for refugees so that they're not arrested under immigration charges, so that groups like Mang Ta are able to run projects to empower the refugee community. We work with private sector so that private sector will come in and support refugee projects and refugee initiatives that help to strengthen the community. So within that environment is how UNHCR, the government, and different partners come in. It makes it complicated because it is all done within the context of an absence of a legal framework. Mm. But in practical terms, it is happening. Refugee protection and assistance is going on. The government supports a lot of the initiatives that the UNHCR is doing and partners are doing.
Is it too much of a complicated question to ask why there are no legal frameworks in place?
That's really the kind of questions that people need to be asking the government. Why isn't it? A lot of the times, it just comes from a lot of governments look at putting in place legal frameworks as something that's unachievable or is too big. A lot of the times, governments think that in order to protect refugees, they must first sign the Refugee Convention, and there comes with that a lot of complications or resistance. I won't be able to speak on behalf of the government on why legal frameworks are not in place. I can say, however, in spite of the absence of the legal framework, cooperation does exist. There is space for people to come forward and help refugees. That's important. The absence of the legal framework makes things complicated because things should be spelled out in law. That's always more helpful. But it does not mean that things can't happen while we wait for the legal framework to be put into place.
Okay, and that's what Mang Ta is doing.
Part of what Mang Ta does is to look at solutions for refugee women that help empower refugee women. I mentioned the special vulnerabilities of women. And what I mean by that is that, you know, being a refugee has already put a person in tremendous disadvantage. You fled your country because of war, because of human rights abuses. You can't go back again. You've lost everything. You fled here because you needed to save your life. So already being a refugee is difficult. Being a refugee woman is even more difficult. You are subject to far more exploitation than a man would be. If you're with children, the responsibility of taking care of every aspect of the children's life falls on the woman. A lot of the times, refugee communities come from countries where women aren't given education. And so when you're in exile, then how do you find the skills to be able to cope with a city like Kuala Lumpur? You know, I've met women from Myanmar who came from villages who've never even seen high-rise buildings. And then you come to Kuala Lumpur and you have to find ways to survive. How do you do that? That's why Mang Ta becomes important. It's looking at the unique vulnerabilities that women face and finding a solution that makes sense for them.
What is it like from a first-hand experience to live in Malaysia as a refugee and as a woman?
It's so difficult for us because of we cannot work with UN card. So that also one thing. Then all the time they can arrest the police also. All the time we are afraid the police, and not only if we are working outside, we cannot get salary more, 800 or 1,000 something. So that is for our family, finance is not sufficient. So all the time we are worried and suffering. So it's so difficult for us, not only that, for our children, education. When I'm thinking for me especially, sometimes I'm crying because of they want to study, but only under the UNHCR school only they can attend school. So sometimes they thinking they want to go the government school or something, but we cannot go.
So that also for us is painful. So everything is for us difficult.
If you come together as a family, do you get to stay together as a family?
Yes.
Maybe I could just add to what Sarah was saying, that when refugees flee and they first come to Malaysia, survival, the ability to cope, falls entirely upon the refugees. UNHCR does not have the resources to be able to give shelter or accommodation or anything like that. So refugees, their ability to be empowered and to help themselves and help each other becomes vital. And Sarah made a good point that the absence of the legal framework means that refugees cannot work legally. But they do work, you know, because there's about 130,000 or so adults. You've got to work, otherwise how do you support your family? But you can't do so legally, and so you're subject to exploitation. Very low wages, cheated out of your wages. If you get injured on the job site, there's no way for you to get compensation for it. Refugee children, as Sarah said, are unable to attend public schools. And so they have to attend schools that are actually set up by the refugees themselves with the support of UNHCR. So you can already see just how difficult survival is. A large part of that also involves refugees being able to come together, support each other, to find ways to navigate through this life here in Malaysia.
I mean, there is that really strong dependence on community because that's all you can rely on. Like, I can't, yeah, it's hard to imagine when you have never experienced living in a country without the support.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Yeah. No, you've hit the nail on the head, Tasha. Every time I think about the refugee people that I meet, and one of the things that I always think about is that if I had to flee, I leave behind everything, and this is what these women have gone through. The people you rely on, your aunts and your sisters and your cousins, who we take for granted to be there for us, we lose all of that.
We'll hear more from Sarah, Hannah and Yanti when we come back. This is Raise Your Game, BFM 89.9.
Build fortunes modestly. BFM 89.9.
Good morning, you're still listening to Raise Your Game. I'm Tasha Fusil and it's World Refugee Day. I'm here with Yanti Ismail, the External Relations Officer at UNHCR, who is here also with Sarah and Hannah, two refugee women from Mangta, an organization that's led by Myanmar refugees who are taking a community-based approach to help women create livelihood in order to support and care for their families.
Just now, Sarah said, when we are living in this Malaysia, very difficult. I have 5 daughters, so more difficult. We don't know the languages, Malayu or English. And then when we seeking the job, no languages, so more difficult for our families. And then all of my daughters are attendants for education, the government school. Cannot attendance because no passport, no IC. The same for the children, no languages. I'm also like this. Every time I cry and I have feel because since we are living in Myanmar, my parents also very poor, so I cannot attend in Myanmar at education. So I never speak, and I never know ABCs also, the alphabet ABC also, I never know. But when I arrive in this Malaysia, in Mangta, I enjoy the Mangta, I learned ABC, start ABC, and then I learned one day 5 meaning. I learn, and then still now, I can speak a little bit in English.
You speak amazing English.
That's what we keep on telling her.
Yeah.
And that's why we are in so much awe of refugees.
Yes.
It's that, you know?
All of the refugees, I think like me, so very difficult.
Out of all the women, you know, the 30% of women, how many get to actually have access to learn what Hannah and Sarah did, you know, to experience some kind of empowerment?
Benefiting from these types of programs?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we wish it was a lot more, but it isn't. I don't have definitive numbers right now, but we know that far more women need this kind of support. Unfortunately, again, it comes down to resources. A lot of the times, there's a reliance on NGOs or on the UN to put together these types of programs, and that's always going to limit us. So we wish that far more women were able to access it, but it's probably not as many as they should. Having said all of that, we do know that one of the models that works the best is actually not necessarily just for the UN or private sector or NGOs to come in and swoop in and try to save the refugee community, but it's to come in from the ground and support the communities because they already have their own solutions. And that's really important for people to remember. Refugee communities in Malaysia are not sitting waiting for charity. I have not met refugee communities who are just sitting back and waiting. They are trying to change their life in Malaysia. They don't know when they can go back home again. And a long-term solution for them is difficult to imagine right now. Many of them are in Malaysia for a decade or more. I've met refugees who've been here for 3 decades. And so while you're here, refugees are finding things to do to help support their own community. Mangta is a refugee women's empowerment group that looks also at providing livelihood opportunities. Like Hannah was saying, women are trained. So you've got literacy, you've got the kind of educational training, but also training in sewing and crafts and marketing and trying to think about how do you help to find ways to help yourself cope with day-to-day. If I can add that when I first got to know Mangta, one of the things that I thought was most unique about it was the fact that they recognized that for a lot of refugee women, leaving their homes is difficult. I was saying just now that the absence of a legal framework means that refugees are considered as undocumented migrants. This means that by law, they are at risk of arrest and detention under immigration charges. And that was what Sarah was talking about just now, the fear. For a woman, especially if you come from a remote village in Chin or up in the mountains, you come to Malaysia, walking out the street is scary. That there's a lot of fear of doing that. Mangta's model is really interesting. You find a safe space for women to just come and learn, and then you can take home the little jobs that you need to do and work from home. And then Mangta partners with different organizations, NGOs, with individuals to help to sell these products, and the income goes back to the women. It's a really practical model that they came up with to support their unique needs. And it's not the kind of thing that UNHCR can come and say, okay, this is what you must do. And that, I think, is important for people to remember. The solutions are there within the refugee community. What they need is help so that they can help themselves.
What do you mean by help? I mean, what is it that we can do?
Oh, plenty. My goodness. Where should we start? I think that for every person who's aware of refugees, understands that they are not illegals, that they have rights just like every other person, and that they cannot return back home safely because, well, to put it bluntly, they may die. They may face situations of danger. You cannot deport refugees out of the country. They need this safe space. If people can understand that, and remove any feelings of xenophobia about foreigners coming in and taking over the country, I think that's a tremendous first step. And then in more practical terms, you can look at what projects are already in place that refugees are already doing. And then you will see quite quickly that within your own spheres of influence, there are ways that you can come in. Don't try to solve 151,000 people's problems. Look at one person at a time. Even helping one group, one community, one learning center, one women's empowerment project, in whatever way you can volunteer. If you're part of a corporation, can you come in and provide skills? If you have funding availability, can you come in and support a trainer to come in and teach a particular type of skill for refugees? Or if you are able to market products produced by refugees, that would be a great way that you can contribute. And we have a few partners who do that for the refugee community groups.
Okay, tell me more about that. I mean, because that is one of the best ways to get awareness going because, you know, of how connected we are online, products, you know, they get the kind of exposure that you need.
Absolutely. I think that's always a model that makes the most sense because it must be said that refugee protection is actually not the responsibility of any one organization. It is not the sole responsibility of UNHCR. It is a state responsibility, but also every single sector of community has a role to play. I think that's important to say from the onset because people often lay blame on others and push it away. We are part of this. Every one of us has a stake in the refugee issue. there's nobody's insulated. No country is insulated. You're looking at 63 million people worldwide now displaced because of war. How can we not? That's more than double Malaysia's population. How can we be insulated from it? We've all got skin in the game, as they say. And when you think about it that way, you can see that if you are able to come and be part of the solution, you're able to help complete the puzzle, the jigsaw puzzle on how you can solve the refugee issue. You have refugee communities with their skills, with their willingness, with their hard work and their tenacity to want to do something. You've got the UN and other NGOs who come in and provide the kind of support to the refugees so that they're able to do these types of work, the trainings that they need. Corporations can come in and look at, with my business model, what can I do to support refugee groups? I'm not able to mention a lot of names. A lot of corporations choose to do this anonymously, but one group such as Fashion Valet has been given, it's an online platform, and has given space for refugee communities to sell their products online. Now, isn't that lovely? Very little cost to anyone, and yet you are able to help a community that deeply needs help. You're not giving charity. It's business. Yet, at the same time, you are providing a service support to people, products that people will want. Another group that's just newly started, it's called Picture Project. Theirs aren't craft products, but they support refugees who have skills in cooking and finding these cooks. And they know these cooks can't sell their food outside, but they can cook. And so the project, like Picture Project, comes in and becomes the platform so that through online connection, people know about the food and are able to buy it through Picture, provided by the refugee community. There's that kind of a model, you know? So not everybody needs to do everything.
And that works within the legal limitations that we
have. Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, look, it's always in the grey area. For as long as there's no refugee laws, it's always in the grey area. But we can say that there's a tremendous amount of tolerance from the Malaysian government towards people helping refugees. We do know that. I mean, Malaysia is incredibly humanitarian. Let's not forget, this is not the first time Malaysia's hosted refugees. It's been doing this for about 50 years now. It had about 250,000 Indo-Chinese refugees at one point. Malaysia is very familiar with what refugees need. While we work with the Malaysian government on things like access to legal work for refugees, ensuring that refugees are not arrested and detained, or enhancing the protection space for refugees, there is still space for corporate companies and NGOs and individuals to come in and do all sorts of things that does not contravene with the law necessarily. There are ways that we can find creative solutions to help refugees.
It's overwhelming.
It isn't. Hey, that's the thing, you see. Never feel that the numbers are overwhelming to you, because then you'll never make that first move to do anything. Mm-hmm. You can't look at it that way. 63 million people worldwide affected by war and conflict. How can you think about helping them? It's too big. It's too large. Never think about it that way. Think about it as Sarah and Hannah, two women. That's within your power. You can help two women. You can talk to UNHCR, whoever's out there who's interested in helping. Contact us, and then we will be able to help guide you. And we're very practical in our approach of how people can help. We never throw 151,000 people to you and say, here, help them all. We don't do that. That doesn't make sense. We find things that are practical. If you are an educational institute, then the solutions would be education-related. We wouldn't throw you and ask you to do livelihoods. That doesn't make sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Yanti Ismail from UNHCR with Sarah and Hannah, two extraordinary refugee women from Myanmar. We continue our conversation when we return here on Raise Your Game, BFM 89.9.
Build fortunes modestly. BFM 89.9.
Good morning, this is Raise Your Game. I'm Tasha Fusil. It's World Refugee Day, and to celebrate the absolute strength and resilience of refugees around the world, we're speaking to Hannah and Sarah, two refugee women from Myanmar. And Yanti Ismail from UNHCR joins us as well. Now, the safety and well-being of your child is what's at the forefront of any mom's mind. And as a refugee, the responsibility to take care of your child falls entirely on the women. Sarah explains what that's like.
Me also, I have four daughters. Three of them, they learn from ACR school, that is under the UNHCR. So now Molly also... Now she's working in shelter, so two of them still they study in ACR. So for my daughter also all the time I'm worried because of the Malaysia situation. Is we cannot we cannot pay the whole floor for rental. So we are living together one floor is five family or four family, like that. So how to say, all the time I'm worried for my daughter because of, you know, my flatmate are, some are Indonesia, some are something. So we need to be careful, the security also. So sometimes I'm worried all the time, not sometimes, all the time, because of our situation is before I explain like that. So that's why, so I'm take care my children are, if they finish the school, they come through with me. Then we go back together like that. I'm taking care of my kid. Just like me, Mangta women also. Some women are, they cannot live in their house. So they bring, if we have training, one woman, four or five kids, they bring to learn knitting or sewing. So all women, we need to take care of our children. So before I already explained, we cannot send good school or education. So we need to think how we will take care of our children. All the time we are worried, most of women. That's why they are bring, if we have training, three or four kids all the time in Mangta. So that's why we have a lot of kids in Mangta. Mm. So the problem is not enough finance for our family. So that's why we can, actually some community, they have nursing school or something. But if we send, we need to pay 100 to 1 month, 200 or 100 something. Per month. So we don't have enough money. So they cannot send the school, some family. That's why all the time we are going four or five kids like that all the time.
You have to take them with you.
Yes.
And that was what we were saying just now about the Mangta model, that it accommodates the fact that a lot of people, women, are left to take care of the children. They can't go out to work. The children, maybe the family can't afford to send them to school. Mangta has an ability for women to be able to still have their children with them. Ideally, of course, children should be in school. Of course, you know, there's 33,000 refugee children in Malaysia. None of them have access to education. The only kinds of education they have are informal learning centres set up by the refugee communities or by UNHCR through NGO partners. And it's still a challenge because the worry of every mother, I'm sure, is what happens next? You have children that go to learning centres that are informal, under-resourced, with teachers that are not trained because they're from the refugee communities themselves. And then what happens next? You can't sit for any qualifying exams in Malaysia because you're not considered as legal. There's very limited secondary level schooling. There's only about 20-something possible locations for these children to attend secondary level. Tertiary is even more limited because if you haven't gone through primary and secondary and received the proper certification, you can't even look at tertiary education. Every mother's worry is that, what happens to my children after this? There's always that worry. And I think that unfortunately is the reality for refugees here, the inability to plan for your future. You live thinking about today and surviving today, protecting my family today. It's very hard to think what's going to happen in a year's time. How will I plan my future after that? The way we see it is because nobody can predict what's going to happen in a year or 2 years or 5 years. But while they are here, there are ways that we can try to give them the skills that they need so that life doesn't just stop. That refugees are still doing things, learning new skills. And this is for actually a very practical reason, not just for livelihoods for them here, self-reliance, not only for that reason, but when the time comes that they're able to return back home, and for most refugees that will happen, peace will come to wherever they're from, you know. We thought that people from the Indonesian province of Aceh, there's 20,000 of them here at one point, we'd never believe that they would go back, but peace came to the province of Aceh. Everybody went home again. Similarly with the Indochinese, they're no longer in Malaysia. It can happen. And when they do go back, isn't it better for them to go back as skilled people who can contribute to rebuilding their country, especially if the country has been war-ravaged, like Syria? Look at how many people have been fleeing, almost 5 million now, You've left a country with more than half of its population gone, displaced. What happens to a country if people then return back home and are unable to rebuild it? That's why it makes practical sense. And actually, that's a contribution Malaysia makes by allowing refugees to have opportunities to learn, to develop skills, to be empowered. You're contributing towards stabilizing the countries where they came from. And that's a really good way of seeing things. I think that we should feel proud of ourselves for allowing that space. There's obviously plenty more that can be done and needs to be done. But we should not, especially today on World Refugee Day, we should also stop and take stock of what's happened, where we are, and how we can come together and support refugees. I think that, I hope that people listening to stories from Sarah and Hannah open their minds to talking to refugees, you know, extending the hand of friendship, getting to know who they are. And really, they're no different than us. It's just fate took them down a different path. It could happen to any one of us. That's the most sobering thought about the refugee plight. And just like us, refugees are made up of families, children, mothers, brothers, and their needs are exactly the same as us as well. And in Malaysia right now, there are opportunities and ways that people can come forward and help in small ways. I suggest that people contact UNHCR or any NGO that they know who's running projects to help refugees and find the way that you can contribute that makes sense to you so that it's sustainable and that it makes sense within your own reality. For refugees, you know, it is World Refugee Day today, and it's the day that we celebrate the resilience of refugees. We recognize what they've gone through, and we know that this is something that we should really respect and be in awe of. The theme of this year is actually to stand with refugees. It's hashtag with refugees.
Okay.
And the idea behind it is to make a call, a rallying call. Stand with us as we stand with refugees, and ask governments to support refugees so that every refugee child has an education, every refugee family has somewhere to go that's safe, and every refugee can work or learn skills to make a positive contribution to their community. So we say, you know, stand, hashtag with refugees. And that's what World Refugee Day today is all about.
We can all stand hashtag with refugees today. You can head to Fashion Valet and look up Mangta. They've got a lovely selection of cross-stitch pouches that you can get for yourself or for your mum or your wife or girlfriend. You can also get in touch with UNHCR if you're keen to find out how you can help. It's been truly humbling to meet these women and to understand the plight of every single person who's ever been displaced from their family, their home and their country. A big thanks to Yanti from UNHCR and, of course, Hannah and Sarah for sharing their stories with us. This has been Raise Your Game, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.